Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni. Today we begin with Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflection, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
The Pharisees and some of the experts in the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus. They had observed a few of his disciples eating meals without having purified, that is to say, washed, their hands. The Pharisees, and in fact all Jews, cling to the custom of their ancestors and never eat without scrupulously washing their hands. Moreover, they never eat anything from the market without first sprinkling it. There are many other traditions they observe. For example, the washing of cups and jugs and kettles. So the Pharisees and the scribes questioned him, Why do your disciples not follow the tradition of our ancestors, but instead take food without purifying their hands? He said to them, How accurately Isaiah prophesied about you hypocrites when he wrote, This people pays me lip service, but their heart is far from me. Empty is the reverence they do me, because they teach as dogmas mere human precepts. You disregard God's commandment and cling to what is human tradition. He summoned the crowd again and said to them, Hear me, all of you, and try to understand. Nothing that enters a man from outside can make him impure. That which comes out of him, and only that, constitutes impurity. Let everyone heed what he hears. Wicked designs come from the deep recesses of the heart. Acts of fornication, theft, murder, adulterous conduct, greed, maliciousness, deceit, sensuality, envy, blasphemy, arrogance, and obtuse spirit. All these evils come from within and render a man impure.
After the parenthesis of the last few weeks, when John's Gospel brought us our Lord's great discourse on the bread of life, we return today to the Gospel of Mark, and a celebrated occasion when Jesus made an important distinction between outward behaviour and inward attitudes. The Pharisees have come from Jerusalem with some of the scribes, the experts in the law, as we heard. Jesus had been in Jerusalem recently, probably for the Feast of Passover, and now he was back in Galilee, probably in Capernaum, which was his base. And these men had followed him, not because they wanted to become disciples, but in order to watch him and his followers, in the hope of catching him out in what he taught or did. They're not long in finding something to criticise.
Why do your disciples not follow the tradition of our ancestors, but instead take food without purifying their hands?
What might to us seem merely a reference to a lack of hygiene was a far more serious accusation of disrespect for an age-old custom, a disregard for that ritual cleanliness which had become an essential part of Jewish life, and to which the Pharisees paid an exaggerated honour. Mark, who was writing for non-Jews, the Romans in particular, goes into some detail in his explanation. They cling to the custom of their ancestors, we heard, and never eat without scrupulously washing their hands. Washing their arms as far as the elbow, runs another version. Next comes the market. Now, not to eat anything from the market without first sprinkling it sounds reasonable enough. We all wash fruit, salad and other vegetables, though we might look askance at someone who insisted on doing the same to dry foods. But in other versions, the picture's a little different. On returning from the marketplace, they never eat without first sprinkling themselves, we read in the Jerusalem Bible. And the Revised Standard Version has, when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they purify themselves. The Vulgate has simply, when they come from the market, unless they be washed, they eat not. The particular complaint the Pharisees make has to do with eating, with food. But if we look at the definition of the Pharisee, separated or set apart, it's hardly surprising that they would feel contaminated every time they went to the market. As one scholar comments, they thought that the market might pollute them. As for the washing of cups and pots and bronze dishes, there was apparently a whole chapter of the Talmud dedicated to that. There were phrases like these. If someone eats bread, and this of course could mean any food, without washing his hands, it's as if he were going with a prostitute. And again, he who despises the washing of hands will be removed from this world. Ominous. And supposing there was no water in the immediate vicinity, what then? One must go and look for it, travelling anything up to 4 miles. So the Pharisee teachers prescribed. Knowing all this as he did, Jesus wastes no time in defending the conduct of his disciples, but goes straight to the heart of the matter. Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, and he quotes the prophet's complaint. Speaking in the name of God, Isaiah had declared,
"This people honours me only with lip service, while their hearts are far from me. The worship they offer me is worthless. The doctrines they teach are only human regulations."
And Jesus concluded,
"You put aside the commandment of God to cling to human traditions."
In Matthew's account of the same episode, he quotes the disciples as saying to Jesus in private, "Do you know that the Pharisees were shocked when they heard what you said?" But our Lord, who naturally knew very well how the Pharisees felt, told his disciples,
"Leave them alone. They are blind men leading blind men. And if one blind man leads another, both will fall into a pit."
It could easily be concluded from this exchange with the Pharisees that Jesus had no respect for tradition or commonly accepted codes of behaviour. But we find him in the Gospels reminding a Pharisee who had invited him to dinner that he had neglected to perform what was a common gesture of courtesy to a guest. A scholar reminds us,
"An important Hebrew custom was the washing of the guest's feet, a gesture of welcome in a hot, dusty country where stony roads often made foot travel a painful experience."
Back in the Old Testament, in fact, there was the famous occasion when Abraham was sitting at the door of his tent in the heat of the day, when, behold, 3 men stood in front of him. And what does he do? He offers them water to drink and to wash the dust from their feet. And the visitors, as we know, turned out to be angels. When Jesus was at table in the house of Simon the Pharisee, a woman known as a sinner came in with an alabaster flask of ointment, and recounts Luke,
"Standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears, and wiped them with the hair of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment."
And Jesus reproaches Simon, who is more concerned to judge his guest for letting himself be touched by a public sinner.
"Do you see this woman? I entered your house, you gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears, and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment."
Apart from the customs of washing after contact with the unclean or before touching food, there was also the opposite, as recounted by Sir James Fraser, the Scottish anthropologist, in The Golden Bough.
"It is a common belief that the effect of contact with a sacred object must be removed, by washing or otherwise, before a man is free to mingle with his fellows. Thus the Jews wash their hands after reading the sacred scriptures. Before coming forth from the tabernacle after the sin offering, the high priest had to wash himself and put off the garments which he had worn in the holy place."
Certainly the whole idea of using water to purify the person, whether in the ordinary act of washing to cleanse the body of dirt or in a symbolic act of spiritual purification, runs through all cultures and all religions. Nor has literature resisted the temptation to use such an act to dramatic effect, as in the sleepwalking scene of Shakespeare's Macbeth, when the guilty queen tries in vain to wash the blood from the hand that has committed murder. A waiting woman takes a doctor to observe Lady Macbeth sleepwalking, and the doctor observes how she rubs her hands. The woman answers, "It's an accustomed action with her to seem thus washing her hands. I've known her to continue in this for a quarter of an hour."
"Yet here's a spot. Out!"
damned spot out, I say. Yet who would have thought the old man to have had so much blood in him? What? Will these hands ne'er be clean? Here's the smell of the blood still. All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand. Oh!
Far removed from the imagination of the dramatist, in the real-life drama of the Passion, there's another scene of ritual hand-washing.
So when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this righteous man's blood. See to it yourselves.
Writes a scholar.
Pilate abjures his responsibility with a typically Oriental symbolic gesture. In reality, his blame is not entirely taken away thus.
Probably no symbolic act of hand-washing is more celebrated than this. There are, of course, genuine acts of this kind, one of which still exists in the church's liturgy. It takes place at the offertory and is one of the quieter, though no less significant, moments of the Mass. After he has offered the water and wine, the priest goes to the side of the altar and washes his hands. The ceremony originated, we're told, in the practical necessity of cleansing the fingers after handling loaves of bread, but came to signify that purity with which the sacred mysteries should be approached. When there's a server, he pours the water over the celebrant's fingers and catches it in a bowl. Until the Second Vatican Council, the priest recited part of a psalm while washing the extremities of his fingers. Known as the lavabo, from the first words he spoke, the ceremony was explained, runs a note in the old Roman Missal, by the mystical reason that one can never be pure enough to touch the God of all purity. The psalm is described as the prayer of a man of integrity, or prayer of the blameless.
I will wash my hands among the innocent, and will compass thine altar, O Lord, that I may hear the voice of praise, and tell of all thy wondrous works. I have loved, O Lord, the beauty of thy house, and the place where dwelleth thy glory. Take not away my soul, O God, with the wicked, nor my life with men of blood, in whose hands are iniquities, their right hand is filled with gifts. But I have walked in my innocence. Redeem me, and have mercy on me. My foot hath stood in the direct way, in the churches. I will bless thee, O Lord.
In a comment on the psalm, a scholar writes,
the text joins this declaration of innocence to an entrance liturgy to the temple, reminding us that the prayer is said by the priest before the great prayer of the Eucharistic canon.
Modern translations make this clear, as in this one.
To prove my innocence, I wash my hands and take my place around your altar.
Or in this.
I wash my hands in innocence and join the procession round your altar.
When our Lord accused the Pharisees of lip service, did he have this psalm in mind? The verse preceding that which opens the lavabo is revealing.
I never take my place with liars, and with hypocrites I shall not go. I hate the evildoers' company. I will not take my place with the wicked.
I refuse to sit down with the wicked, runs another version. It does smack strangely of the Pharisees' attitude and their disapproval of Jesus for sitting down with sinners. In the last part of today's Gospel, Jesus calls the crowd to him and urges them to try to understand that only what comes out of a man can make him impure. But how much the crowd understood is doubtful, as even his followers questioned him, writes Mark, when he had gone back into the house, away from the crowd. Perhaps today we think we have understood, but can we claim honestly to be better than the Pharisees? As a modern scholar comments,
the same faults could be urged against ourselves. Catholics from the highest to the lowest have been guilty of them. St. John Chrysostom was not the first or the last to say, we imitate the hypocrites, we have even surpassed them.
Perhaps we would do well to remember what St. Paul wrote to the Corinthians. Let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now we take a look once again at the past week's events here in the Vatican. Our resident Vatican expert Joan Lewis sat down with me to review some of the highlights of the past 7 days. Good morning, Joan, and a very warm welcome back after this long, hot summer.
Yes, we both been away on our vacation, and part of mine was working, and I think we'll have a few minutes today for me to tell you about my adventures. But actually, I was in the U.S., part of the time, of course, to see family and friends, and I was in Florida and also Southern California. But I have to say, Southern California, it was that 11-day period in August every year when they get warm. So I think I escaped humidity, but I did not escape warm temperatures.
Well, we didn't here either.
No.
You know that.
Oh no. I followed that, and our pastor sends weekly newsletters, and you know, like notwithstanding air conditioning, I'll change clothes three times a day.
Yeah.
So we're in an air conditioned studio, so we should we should do well today with our thoughts.
But it's still quite quiet in the Vatican, is my feeling.
Oh, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I have to say to my listeners, to our listeners, I love this time of year, the July and August, notwithstanding the heat of the city and so forth. But the Holy Father's away, most members of the Roman Curia are away, for those of us who cover the Vatican. We're taking our vacations ourselves, but the city empties. Romans go elsewhere, out of the country or to the seashore or mountains. Very little traffic on the street. There's actually seats on buses. It's just generally
quiet.
Well, I'm not talking about if you stand in line to go visit St. Peter's Basilica, but your tourist spots are crowded. But boy, just the neighborhoods where we live, it's a wonderful.
It's lovely.
The frenetic pace is not there in the summer, and it's really, really wonderful for all of us.
But having said that, the Pope has been continuing in his activities from Castel Gandolfo.
Sunday he recites the Angelus, and then during the week he has had resumed on August 1st, the general weekly audience. And it's very interesting because in the past he's been at the inside the balcony for the inside courtyard where he's often had Angelus and the Wednesday audience. But now they open the front door of the Apostolic Palace that faces onto the Piazza della Libertà of Castel Gandolfo, and that's where he kind of gives the general audience.
Is that so that he can speak to more people?
I wondered about that myself, and I remember in the beginning of the summer seeing some pictures of work being done on the inner courtyard. Now, whether scaffolding or things like that affect, obviously, the number of people that can be present, I think it's only a few thousand that can fit inside, so yes, more people could come into the town square and just pour out that
right.
main street and all the little side streets. So I would say, yes, he can probably address more people. So Sunday, as he always does at the Angelus, he talks about that day's gospel. And then he will make an appeal for some place in the world where there's strife, violence, and war going on. But what I liked about this past Sunday, obviously, I guess as an American, the Pope did greet the 62 new students at the Pontifical North American College, and called NAC, N-A-C, by those of us who live here. The NAC is the National Seminary of America in Rome, and the Pope told these seminarians, 62, that's a huge number. There's something like 240 students
all together
at NAC. It's an amazing. So vocations are increasing, and that's a wonderful sign. By the way, these 62 men come from 46 U.S. dioceses, and there are two Australian dioceses and one Canadian represented in that number as well. But the Pope has asked them to use their time in Rome, they'll be here 4 years, to conform themselves more completely to Christ. And what was fun was that the students sang Ad Multos Annos, wishing the Pope many, many years. And he applauded in thanks. And so he prayed the seminarians and all Catholics would remain faithful to the Lord even when our faith in his teachings is tested. And I think we've seen and heard and read a lot of that lately, too. So a lovely, sunny, warm day, but still thousands of people, you know, flock to see the Holy Father. And also, you know, if you're not a Custa Gandolfo, all you have to do is go to St. Peter's Square.
And
because they've got
screen.
The huge screens
That's
up
right.
there. And you can follow the Pope as if he's right with you. So that's always a good
right.
event for people. Because
right.
it's not easy to get to Custa Gandolfo.
No,
to the town itself. The train
I
that brings you there.
I don't think there's a direct line there, is there?
There is a train, but I mean, oh my word. Once you get out at the station, it's about the size of the room we are talking in. And really, it's very, very small if you've ever been there. And then it's a huge climb uphill to the center of Castel Gandolfo. So, you know, if you have your own car or go in a group bus, that's probably the best way. But it's definitely worth it. Beautiful place.
Yes.
A lot of nice restaurants overlooking
the lake,
which is a
Lake Albano,
a quiet volcano. Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. exactly. So, and then that's where the Pope held the Wednesday audience too, in which he spoke of the feast of John the Baptist's martyrdom, and that's August 29th, of course. And I love what he said. He said that John's greatness came from prayer, from his relation with God, which is what prayer is. It's our talking to God, and when we're successful, it's our listening to God as well. He does talk to us. Sometimes we are not ready to listen or don't know how. But the Pope said, John the Baptist's martyrdom reminds us, Christians of our time, that we cannot stoop to compromises with the love of Christ, his word, the truth. The truth is the truth, and there is no compromise, he said during that general audience. And going back to what he said about John's prayer life, he said the courage to tell the truth, to live the truth, can only come from a solid relationship with God. And listen to this, I love it. Prayer is not a waste of time. It does not rob much space from our activities, not even apostolic activities. It does the exact opposite. Only if we are able to have a life of faithful, constant, confident prayer will God himself give us the strength and capacity to live in a happy and peaceful way, to overcome difficulties, and to bear witness with courage, which we always do need, I think, to bear witness to our Christianity. And he asked St. John the Baptist to intercede for us so we may always maintain the primacy of God in our lives. And it was very interesting. We mentioned just a second ago that the audience was in the square in front of the Apostolic Palace. But after the audience, the Pope had multilingual greetings, as he always does. But then he went back inside to the inner courtyard of the Apostolic Palace. And there were, so I guess maybe the if there's any repair work done, it's over. There were 2,600 French altar servers.
Oh, gosh.
So boys and girls. And they were among the many thousands, of course, of the faithful who had come there. And the Pope said, if you all in your lives hear the call, if you hear God calling you to the priesthood or religious life, answer with generosity. So had to be a special day. These altar servers came, I believe, I'm not sure, that it's an annual pilgrimage that they make from France.
So young boys, so, I imagine.
Yeah, and boys and girls.
Boys and girls.
Yes, uh-huh. And so they make this annual pilgrimage, and that's a lot of people to make a trip together, isn't it? That's a lot of buses and trains and things like that. So
the only other papal activity I can think of is a telegram he sent, right, Joan?
Right. Oh, my gosh, this is so sad. I'm sure that our listeners have, you know, heard on the radio or read in the papers about the huge explosion in Venezuela, where at least as of Monday, 48 people had died. It was an explosion at Venezuela's largest refinery, and actually one of the largest in the world. And there was some kind of a gas leak which led to this explosion. And I believe I read only a day or two ago that the fire was still burning from the gas. And so obviously the Pope sent condolences. He wrote to the Archbishop of Cumana, Venezuela, for this, for the victims. And he said he was very, very saddened by the news of the serious accident and prayed for the repose of the souls of the dead. And he asked that the international community, the national community, you know, close in solidarity and help all those who were wounded and harmed. And I thought it was very interesting that the government, in a statement, mentioned that most of the victims were members of the National Guard and their families. Now, the National, and they live right on the premises or next to the refinery. These men are charged with protecting the security of the refinery. Mm-hmm. So here that you had children, oh, wives, terrible. You know, sisters and so forth. So many, many people of the National Guard and which is obviously very sad.
Very sad. You just had a wonderful trip to the States, you said, but you also mentioned you went to Hawaii.
Oh, may I tell you, Hawaii is an earthly paradise. You could never see a movie, a picture, a postcard that is doctored to present the colors. The vividness of the flowers. I cannot tell you the types of flowers. I don't even know them all. The beauty of the flowers, the vividness of the colors, the water. I mean, you go to Waikiki Beach and it's like, I can drink this, you know? And then you'll see 100 feet out, that turns into another shade. I've got some pictures that show three or four different shades of the blue in the water. Now, I did not go to, you know, walk on the beach or anything. I did not go. I wanted to go parasailing. I really did, but literally ran out of time. I was actually in Hawaii for work. And when I would tell people, they'd kind of go, yeah, right. And then I would say, no, truly, I am going to research and walk in the footsteps of Mary Ann Cope, a sister of St. Francis, a nun, the mother of her order for many years, who became a blessed in 2005, and who will be canonized a saint October of this year. And Mary Ann was in Hawaii for 35 years, 30 of which were spent on the peninsula of Kalupapa. The first few years were spent along with Father Damien, now Saint Damien, who worked with the victims of Hansen's disease, leprosy.
So when is the canonization?
October 21st. And it's wonderful. I mean, you can have Bishop Silva here. He's leading of Honolulu. He's leading a pilgrimage. Steve Prokoff, who heads the Park Service.
Will she be canonized on her own, or will there other be?
No, I think there's five others. We have another American, the Indian, Kateri Tekawita. But what amazes me as I tell the story is you've got this little peninsula, this speck of dust almost in the Pacific island on the whole face of the earth, and it has two saints.
Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That's all from the English feature program today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we will be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.va. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.